Ladies and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of the largest and oldest wrestling family on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome your Studcast host of television and radio fame, Tony Basilio.
Hello again, friends. This is the great Brian Last. I'm happy to once again be filling in here on the Studcast. Of course, you know what this show is. It's the Tennessee Stud himself, Ron Fuller, the legend, telling you stories about his career and the life and career of his family in professional wrestling. I am very honored right now to have on the line the Tennessee Stud himself, Ron Fuller. Ron, how are you today?
I'm great, Brian, and it's so happy to have you with me. A lot of great comments last week. I mean, you have really made a name for yourself in the podcast industry, and obviously everybody was thrilled to have you sit in, And I really feel I'm honored to have you on that end there, and I look forward to continuing on to where we left off last week and getting into my actual career and finally going to get myself into the ring on a regular basis. And I think my entire story and all of these studcasts that I have done previously, the 31 episodes previously, have been building to this point, and now I begin to be able to tell the story from my point of view and the life I actually lived in it.
Well, that's one of the interesting things you're going to do here today. You're not just going to talk about that first time in a territory on a regular basis and all the wrestlers you worked with. You're going to talk about a very unique perspective, the perspective of a wrestler breaking in and what their first month is like.
Yes, I thought we would do something a little different today, and I think fans out there must wonder what it's like to actually be a wrestler, and what's easy and what's difficult. And I figure today we'll start with something like your first month. I want to talk about a wrestler's first month, and I can do it from a real genuine perspective because I've been there and I've done it. And it's been much easier. It's a much easier thing for me to do than the average guy. The average guy that starts out as a new wrestler, he doesn't come from a family background. He has to start from a position that I would have been very uncomfortable with had I not been reared in a wrestling family and part of a dynasty of some respects, a third generation in the sport. That makes it so much easier for you because you've seen it and you've met a lot of wrestlers. And it is hard for me sometimes to really think. I just want to take a guy like, let's say, Rip Rogers as an example, who started out, had to make his own way and tried to became a little better. He moved from territory to territory. He wasn't well known. Those type of people have a real difficulty, I'm sure, much more than what I experienced. But I want to talk about what I experienced and what Rob experienced. And at the same time, you've got Jimmy, who's a brand new worker, another third generation that's in there now. You've got Roy Lee Welch and Jackie Welch. You've got a lot of family members that are just breaking in the late 60s and the early 70s. And I want to talk about kind of what we encountered, and it's a little different than what some encountered, but I think people will find it interesting. Fans will find this interesting. First of all, you have to be able, in order to become a great wrestler, and I think what WWE misses now and what a lot of other businesses maybe missed in the past is you have to have that ability to work every night. It's really almost impossible to learn how to wrestle if you can't do it on a regular basis. And what happens today in businesses are independent, and all these little territories are little operations that are independent operations, and they operate on Friday or on Saturday night. Those guys never have the chance to wrestle every night. And that's so important in developing your skills as a wrestler and honing your skills as to what you do in the ring, what you do and what you don't do in the ring. And it's really, I don't think you can put enough emphasis on the fact that even the guys that work with WWE, they don't work every night. They used to be, back in the days when WWE was just getting kicked off, they were running events every night, and most of those guys were on those contracts, and they worked live events night after night. They worked televised events sometimes, but they were actually working 5-6 times a week. And that has kind of gone away even from Vince's operation. They don't work as many times as they used to. And that hurts them, I believe, in developing their talent and developing the skills of those guys. Some of the things that people don't probably aren't aware of is mats. The mats on a ring are not, you know, people look at them and you cannot see the surface of a mat. And when you feel the surface of a mat, it's something really unique. It's a different type of thing. It can't be slippery. It's got to have traction, and it's got thousands and thousands of small dimples built into the mat. And those dimples take your skin off your body in your first month of wrestling. We're going to talk about the first month, basically, what young wrestlers encounter. And the first thing, and one of the most difficult for me, was that mat burns. You get mat burns. You get them on your knees, and you get them on your elbows, and you get them on your back. They don't seem to go away for months. It takes a long time for your skin to get tough. And what happens is the mats quit burning you after a while. It's not because the mats have changed. It's because your body and your skin have changed. It's become tougher, and it's more difficult to mat burn you after a while than it is when you first start. What's really difficult, Brian, is those knees. Your knees seem to be, every time you go down on your knees a lot of times. And when you do, if you don't have knee pads on, and I didn't start with knee pads, I started without knee pads, and I stayed that way for a big portion of my career until I realized that they not only protect you from that mat, but they also, in some cases, keep your knees from going the wrong direction sometimes, and it save you bad injury too. So I go without knee pads as a young guy in my first month, or actually my first year probably. And when you get the burns on your knees from the mat, it doesn't just bother you during the match, because you've got it skinned off. If a person can imagine, you've got a skin place on your knee one night. The next night, the first thing that happens is you go right down to that same spot, and now you're bleeding. And that blood runs down your knees, down your shins, and into your boots. And you get to where it not only affects you in the ring, but when you get ready to go home and you put your pants on, that those things open up and they start to ooze, and it your skin sticks to your pants. And then when you take your pants off, you peel off another layer of skin. It just continues for a long time. It's very, very uncomfortable. I don't think people think about that very much, but it was one of the worst things that I encountered when I first started. Then you got body aches. You get so many different types of body aches because you're not used to being slammed, and you're not used to all the movement. You're not used to the contact. You're not used to the blows. Everything in the match seems to hurt. it has a cumulative effect on you to where after 30 days of maybe you've wrestled 28 out of 30 days in a row and your body is not used to it and you are breaking down. You're like, wow, I don't know I'm going to be able to do this. This is just killing me. So you've got aches and pains everywhere. And that takes a while for your body to adjust to. Everything is an adjustment when you're a young wrestler. Those mat burns, the body aches, the blowing up, you don't have any wind in your body. Your lungs don't have a capacity to wrestle a bit to begin with. Your nerves have an effect on that. You go into every match in your first. I did it probably for my first 6 months. I don't think I ever went to a match that I was not extremely nervous going out there. Even 6 months in, it takes a long time to get comfortable with what's about to happen out there and to get comfortable with knowing that you're going to do a pretty good job, that you're not going to hurt somebody or not going to get hurt, hopefully. And all of those things combined to make it very hard on a new guy. I found out that I would blow up sometimes in the first 5 minutes of the match, and I really hadn't done anything. And because those nerves are there, it just compiles and complicates everything there, makes it more difficult to get out there and be able to do what you want to do, because you're going to run out of breath pretty quickly. And as the match goes on, you're going to get into a shape where you're going to be hard pressed to do what you need to do at the end of it to make it the type of match you really want to have and to begin with.
You brought up earlier the idea that guys in the WWE today, to their detriment, they're not working 6 days a week. But not only when you broke in, did you work 6 days, sometimes 7 days a week, sometimes eight times in 7 days, but you also worked in front of a regular audience. The people who saw you 1 week would either see you the next week or perhaps 2 weeks later, but it wasn't just a different city every night. It was the same audience regularly. And I wonder what you think the benefits of that are.
Oh, it's obviously, first thing is that you can get yourself over quicker. The bad side of it, the negative side of it is you can kill yourself quicker too. I mean, you can go out there and have some bad matches as a young guy and people go, wow, he's horrible. He can't do anything. So, you know, it can be good and bad for you depending on, but they get used to seeing you. And that's a great point, Brian. You know, you go to different cities and they don't know who you are. In the old territory days, you wrestled in the same towns week after week, and those fans became familiar with you pretty quickly, and they learned to either appreciate how good you were or to down you as just this guy is not good at all. So you had to be very careful what happens to you in your first month. If you get lucky enough to get into a territory, a lot of guys started differently than my brother and I and Jimmy and Lester's sons, because they had followed in the reputation of their father. And when you do that, you're more respected and you get the chance to not just be a job guy who's going to come in and get beat 10 weeks in a row on television. And obviously, you have no way to become a full-time wrestler if you're going to get beat 10 times in a row on TV. Makes sense, I think, to anybody that they're not going to want to see that guy. So if he comes in and he just starts doing jobs on TV, how's he ever going to become a star, or how is he even going to ever get a spot to where he can work every night? It's a very difficult situation for somebody who comes into the sport who doesn't have that family background, doesn't have that respect that you have to earn otherwise. And it's much easier for me and for my brother and the other two Welch boys, Lester's sons and Jimmy Golden, because they had that name and a little bit of reputation.
On the topic of training to be a professional wrestler, you were talking about the bumps and bruises that you have to get used to, that your body must adjust to. What about running the ropes? What was that like when you first started doing that?
Well, oh gosh, I mean, you do all, you do crisscrosses. It seems like sometimes you do crisscrosses for 30 minutes. You know, I mean, you try, you're, when you start to learn to wrestle, it's, it, it encompasses so many different aspects of the game. Some guys want to learn to wrestle on the mat. They want to learn to do actual wrestling moves. Some guys don't want to do that at all. They just want to fly. They want to be off the ropes and drop kicks and flying head scissors and whatever the moves are. There's so many different things you can do in a ring. You have to, as a young wrestler, you have to start making decisions pretty early as to what kind of style am I going to present to people out there? What works for me? And that's critical, Ben, being a young wrestler. You don't want to do things that you don't do well. You want to push and you want to emphasize your strengths. And if you have a weakness, say, let's say you don't stomp a guy very well, then I got to where I wouldn't do those bad moves. Those things that I didn't do well, I figured out pretty quickly that I don't want to try to learn these because I have some things that I do pretty well and I want to enhance those. And those decisions have to be made early on in your career. Or you don't have a career because you have a limited time to make yourself, to get yourself over somewhere. And if you don't get that, if you don't do that and accomplish that, then they don't want you anymore. And the promoter says, hey, look, I can't use you. You're just not ready yet, or whatever the excuse may be. But it's really tough for young guys. And I mentioned Rip Rogers as an example because I think he's a guy who started without having great training, without having respect, without having anybody know who he was, who had to build and work his way from the bottom toward the top. And I had a whole different route than Rip did, and so did my brother and Roy Lee and Jackie Welch and Jimmy and a lot of the Fields Brothers boys. They're getting started at the same time, and their route to being a success was much easier than most of the other guys. And I can only attribute that to that making it easy for me to my dad and my grandfather and all the people in my in the business before me that that earned that respect, and it got passed along to me.
When you first broke in, one of the things that is easy to notice is that you weren't the only young guy. And I wonder whether you think that was beneficial to you, the fact that when you broke in, Rob was there, Bob Armstrong, it's most people don't think of Bob as a young man, but Bob Armstrong was there as a relatively young man. You had Roy Lee Welch there, of course. Even guys who had been around a little while, like Nick Bockwinkel and Dick Steinborn and Jody Hamilton, were still relatively young. How different do you think your experience would have been if you were breaking into a territory and you were the only young guy in that dressing room, or I should say locker room?
It would have been extremely, extremely difficult for several reasons. One of the reasons is the fans are going to compare you. They're going to compare you to another young guy. They can tell a guy's young. They see you're young by looking at your face and looking at your body and watching you in the ring. But let's take another group of guys. You got a great group of guys that are examples out in Georgia. Now, when I go to Florida 3 months down the road, I'm going to get in there with Mike Graham and Dick Slater and Bob Orton Jr. And, you know, they're Austin Idol, Dennis McCord. I mean, there's going to be that nucleus of young guys. And that what made territory so great, and it's what made the business so great, is there always was, everywhere you went in every territory, that nucleus of young talent that had that driving ambition that wanted to get to the top. And it pushed you as a young guy, as one of those guys, to say, I want to be the best of this group. And if you could be the best of that group, then when you went to another territory, if you were the best of that group, then you got to seeing that, hey, I've got some potential here to be somebody and to make it. But it's a good point. I mean, you needed that young talent, and that young talent all did jobs. That young talent, you didn't start, I don't care, even starting from a family like I came from, you didn't start as a champion overnight. You did not win matches. You had to earn your respect. And I think that's a key word to all the young guys that came into the business is they learned that that was what it was all about. You had to have respect for the guys that were there. You had to have respect for the guys who had been there. And you had to have respect for the business and respect for how it worked. And it, respect was the key word when you were a wrestler. It didn't make any difference whether you're young or old, but certainly when you were young, you didn't have respect. You didn't have a chance.
You've talked in the past on the Studcast about when your family first moved to Atlanta, and of course, your father ends up doing some tremendous business with the Atlanta Wrestling Office. But what is it like for you? Because these aren't strangers. So many of the people in the crew currently working in Atlanta when you're breaking in 1970 are guys who had been around for years, guys who knew you, guys who knew your family. So what was that like, having your relationship change from just being the son of the promoter, the grandson of Roy Welch to some people, to being, he's another worker. He's in here with us. He's one of the boys.
Well, it was, there again, that respect word comes back in play, because they had more respect for you than just somebody that shows up there, some young kid that they've never heard of. They had respect for your father, and in my case, for maybe my grandfather as well. And that filtered down some to me and Rob, obviously, and it makes it much easier for us. But that respect word was really, really what really had to happen. I want to back up just a second, Brian, and we talked about the body aches and the pains. I want to talk about one particular injury that I think all young wrestlers have, and it is an elbow injury. It's called the bursitis sac. There's a sac in your elbow that you don't know about. Most people never experience this injury. I think I call it, to me, it's a wrestling injury that, pretty well just comes from wrestling, and knees and elbows, anything that you happen to bang, you repetitively impact one part of your body. And when you take bumps, you fling your arms out to the side because you want to, first of all, you want to even out the impact on your body. You don't want your back to take the whole blow. You want your back and your arms and your legs, your feet, your butt. You want all that impact to be spread over a bigger area. Then you stand less chance of being hurt, and you also are going to have a much longer career. Those guys find out early, these young guys, some of them, how to take bumps. And if they don't figure out pretty quickly how to take bumps and they take something consistently wrong, they're going to have, as time goes by, injuries to hips or backs, lower backs, to arms, legs, whatever it may be. So you have to be cognizant of what's going on with your body and how and what you're actually doing in there. Now, elbows were always bad for me. I would fling my arms out and I would smack my elbows a lot. And I used to get what's called bursitis. I never knew what it was, but it's bursitis. And there's a bursa sac in your joint areas. It's in your shoulders, in your knees, in your elbows, places where bones connect and they interact with each other. And when I would hit my elbows a lot, that bursitis sac would fill up. And this happened to me many, many, many times in the first 6 months. It would get huge. The elbow would get like a grapefruit, and it would be hot. At night when you wrestled and you were going home, you could just touch it, and it felt like it was 150 degrees. It wasn't a body, part of your body almost. It had that temperature and that infection in there all the time. And what I found out later on, and this gives people probably an idea of how tough things were, I figured out later on that I get these elbows like this, and I could not get them to go down. And one night I said to myself, you know, and I did not know. Nobody said, Ron, you need to go do this. I said, this sack that's in my elbow here that won't go away, it was ugly. And fans could see it. They would look at your body and they're bound to go, wow, what's wrong with his elbow? So, yeah, I mean, it was, you know, the thing looked huge and it was obviously painful and it was extremely painful. So I said, I'm going to figure out how to do this, how to get rid of this. And I backed up to a wall one night. I can't remember where I was, probably second, third month wrestling. I'd already had four or five of these. It would go down and then I'd bang my elbow a little bit. It'd be right back 2 days later, right back 2 days later. It just kept coming back. And I backed up to the wall and I took my arm and I smashed my elbow on purpose into the wall. And it, within 10 seconds, the elbow was gone. Every bit of that.
Wow.
It disappeared. And I found out how to bust my bursa sack. That's what it was called. And then I started telling guys, and guys would feel sorry for me. Jack Briscoe, in my early days in Florida, he would always go, Ron, gosh, your elbow looks horrible, man. You got to figure out what to do, man, to get rid of that. And that's kind of pushed me to trying to figure out for myself how I can relieve my own pain. And I smashed that sucker one night and he says, wow, what happened to your elbow? And I said, man, I think I figured it out. He goes, what'd you do? And I said, I smashed it against the wall. And he goes, oh, gosh, man. He goes, gets this look on his face like, wow, you're serious. I go, yeah. And I go, look, it's gone. So, you know, I learned some things early on that helped me to keep my pain level down. And that's what you've got to do. You've got to keep you have to keep yourself going or you're not going to last very long. And you had to do things like that. And I figured out how to do that. I passed that on to a lot of guys, young guys especially, after that. And a lot of them would, you know, they would go, Ron, that sounds great, but I don't got the guts to do it. This thing hurts so bad. How do you smash it into a wall, man, and break that thing? I go, well, if you don't, you're going to have much more pain in the long run. So it was different. Just the things you dealt with as a young guy and just getting off, trying to get better. And you had to spend a lot of times. It was so important, Brian, to watch matches. I mean, that was key. I thought I'd always watched a lot of matches when I was a kid and growing up. But I found that once I started actually wrestling, I wanted to just – I was hungry for it and I watched everybody and I tried to take what the best moves they had and I tried to put it into my repertoire. And what I tried to do every night is I would try to go out and do just one thing new that I hadn't done yet. And I would make up my mind in the dressing room before I went to the ring. I've never thrown a drop kick. I'm going to drop kick somebody tonight. And so, you know, then you added moves that way. You learned how to do different things. My dad told me years ago when I was young and I got big and tall, he said, you don't want to become a big, huge wrestler that can't move. He says, you want to try to be able to do everything anybody else can do. You don't let your size and your height limit you. And that was probably one of the some of the greatest advice I ever got, because it pushed me from the very beginning of trying to develop my style into developing a style in which I could do everything that anybody else could do. And I learned to do it, not only to do it, but to highlight the fact that I could do a flying head scissor. I could do a drop kick. I could do whatever any other small guy could do. And I used to try, and I always did, even to the very end, of being just as fast as a small guy. Being able, if I'm going to drop elbows, I want to drop 5 elbows in 3 seconds. You know what I mean? Up and down and up and down and up and down. And that helped me tremendously to develop a style in which a lot of people would say, you know, Ron, you can do anything anybody else can do. And I literally could. And I thought that was really important for me in the development of my style. There's another thing I used to do, too, is I look for mentors. When I was in my first few months, I would talk to guys that were really good. And I would say, would you mind watching my matches for me? And then critique it. You know, after the match, I want to sit down with you, give me 10 minutes and tell me everything I did wrong. Tell me everything I could do better. And those guys that I hooked up with and that were good about doing that with me helped me so much, because you can't see your match. You're in that match, but you can't see it from a perspective of a fan. So you need that. You need that advice. And some guys were just great at it. Some guys were so super at it. And we're going to talk about one here as we go a little further. When we get into the crew that was there in Georgia in 1970, is Nick Bockwinkel. And Nick Bockwinkel took a interest in me, and I'm not sure why, but Nick Bockwinkel was absolutely one of the greatest workers of all time, in my opinion. He could have been NWA world champion. He could have been any world champion he wanted to be. And he took a lot of time with me in the first 3 months that I was wrestling, and I didn't have to ask him every night. He was there when the match was over. He'd say, come in here, Ron. And he would sit and talk to me. He was so fabulous to me. And I respect him to this very day. And I couldn't have had a better mentor in my first 3 months than him. And he just kind of took it upon himself to talk to me every night about it. It was a wonderful thing to have that type of individual take care of you.
Certainly, and it sounds like Nick Bockwinkel was as classy with you as his reputation is with everyone else, but I want to take a step back before we get into that Georgia crew, Ron. One question popped into my head listening to you talk about your drop kicks, and I always thought you had a great drop kick, which is really impressive considering your height. But in regards to your height, and going to that earlier conversation about aches and pains, is there anything specific that you would have dealt with that the average wrestler wouldn't have in terms of the aches and pains because of your height? Were there any detriments to being 6'9", working a schedule as often as you did?
Well, there are obvious detriments, and the detriments are your bumps are, you've got more body. You know, if you're 5'9", and as compared to 6'9", you're more compact, and you don't have limbs hanging out there and sticking out there, and you're going to probably be easier for you to take a bump, a suplex as an example, than a big guy my size, because it's not as far to go. In my case, I was more concerned about the wrestlers I wrestled against, because that extra foot of height makes a big difference on a suplex. When I suplex somebody, I was more concerned about the suplex and how it affected them. And I think a lot of guys, young guys, did not do that. I always had a concern for the other guy. I was always wanting to make sure I didn't hurt somebody. And that was, you couldn't hurt people every night, because you had to wrestle every night. And if you got hurt every night, you're not going to be able to wrestle every night. And it's not long till you're not wrestling hardly any nights. And so it was a fine line you walked in that ring as to how much you could do, but you had to be very careful not to overdo it and to hurt somebody and put them out so that they couldn't make a living. It was a difficult sport to learn in the early days. Very difficult.
Was it scary for you the first time you threw a drop kick?
No, because I had thrown a lot of drop kicks in training. Corsica Jean trained Rob and I for a considerable length of time. We spent a lot of years with a guy named Charlie Carr, an old timer that trained Jesus, my dad, and Lester, and all of the Fields brothers. And I found out the other day he trained Ron Wright. I mean, he's trained different guys from all over. But you get those training from different people. And once you start training to actually wrestle, It's different than training on the mat. Charlie trained me on the mat. Charlie taught me a lot of shooting. Charlie taught me the basics, the sit outs and the switches. And he taught me wrestling moves and what the sport was all about. But then when you move to the next level and you start training for the ring, now you're going to learn drop kicks and you're going to learn tackles and you're going to learn leapfrogs and you're going to learn all these different types of moves that didn't have anything to do with what Charlie trained you to do. And it's a whole new ball game at that point. Are you going to have the skills not only to do what you need to do on the mat, but are you going to have the skills to do what people want to see happen in the ring? It is a very difficult business and a very difficult sport to be able to go from being an unknown and being green to being somebody that can get it done every night and have a great match every night.
Well, you certainly had a great crew to work with you to get you to that point where you could have a great match every night. Let's talk a little bit about this crew. You brought up Corsica Jean, who trained you. Of course, he was one of the many heels that were working in Georgia in 1970 when you broke in.
Yes, yes. And he had another brother. I'm not sure he was his brother, but I think they probably were. He had originally, he used to be a great tag team with Corsica Jean and Corsica Joe. They're from the Isle of Corsica, actually, and he's from there. You know, he spoke the Italian, and he did the whole deal, you know, and he was a great, great worker. And he taught us, Rob and I, all kinds of working. He took care of us, and there's a lot to that too. And being a great trainer of people and not hurting them and not having them hurt each other. I'll give you an example, Brian, which is a really good story. My dad, after about 3 months, one time he says, "You guys going to train today?" I said, "Yeah, we are. We're right at our way." And of course, Kajin lived 40 miles away. So he said, "I'm going to go with you." So me and Rob were a little hesitant, like, "Oh, geez, man, I don't know about this." You know, we hadn't worked out with him. We hadn't done that type of training with him. We've done a lot of shooting, but we've not done that type of training. And he goes and he's showing Rob how to punch. And the very first time he hits Rob, Rob throws his shoulder up, trying to block the punch, and it glanced off of his shoulder, the punch, and hit him right in the throat, hit Rob right in the throat. And Rob went down, he was choking. Yeah, the first time I'd seen us hurt was Dad. And Corsica Gene says, hey, what are you doing? He goes, "I'm trying to train them not to do that. I'm trying to train them not to hurt each other, not to hurt somebody," right? So it was kind of a funny little deal. Dad was always considered to be stiff. And most wrestlers always told me your dad was stiff and difficult to work with. And so, you know, but some of that's good. I think some of that's good. I think I tried to develop a style that was there was a little stiffness there. I did not want people to be able to watch my match and go, "Wow, that's a bunch of fake stuff." There wasn't fake stuff in what I did. I did not mind making it a little hard on the guys I was in the ring with, but I didn't want to hurt them. Now, when you're young, you hurt people. I'll give you two examples. There's a guy named Tony Nero who was in that first crew that I work with. He's a heel. He's about a 320-pound guy. He's an Italian guy. He's got a huge belly. And so one night I'm working with him. This is early in the career, and it's time for me to make a comeback. And I ball up my fist, and I'm going to hit him in his stomach. And I hit him on one side of my stomach, and my thumb is sticking out beside my fist for some reason. And I've got a fingernail that's long on my thumb, and it starts on one side of his stomach and it goes all the way around his stomach. I collect a roll of skin off of his belly that I peel off a fingernail full of skin off of his stomach. And he's a big guy anyway, and he's working with these young guys. And he's getting hurt anyway. And so he's very uncomfortable working with you when you're young. And so I do this to him and he screams louder than a woman in pain and runs backwards and looks down at his belly like he's bleeding, like he's expecting blood to come flowing out of him or something. And I'm like, whoa, geez, Tony. I mean, I know it was bad, but it couldn't be that bad. Another example is Rob and I working with Chadi and Fuji, two Japanese. Fuji will become a really big star in Japan. He's young. He's very young. Chadi's the older of the two. Chadi speaks a little English. Fuji speaks no English at this point. And Fuji is he's a great Japanese wrestler as time goes by. We're wrestling tag matches a lot together. And one night we wrestle in Macon, Georgia. And I've got Chadi in the turnbuckle, and I'm pounding him across the chest. I mean, I'm wearing him out, probably knocking the breath out of him with every punch. And he bends forward and says, "Beel," like beel me across the ring. And when he leans in, I come with one of these punches across his supposedly his chest. But now he's leaned into it, and I hit him on the nose. And I break his nose. It's like, down he goes, face first, and we're all four in the ring. Rob and Fuji are paired off, and I'm paired off with Chadi. And I hit him in the nose. He goes down, big puddle of blood, and it just starts coming out from his head. His head's laying down face first, and I see it. I'm like, oh, my gosh, this is horrible. And so Fuji gets mad, but you know, I'm a pretty big boy, and he don't really know much about me, you know. So he instead of coming to me, he turns to Rob, and he points at him. He goes, "You!" And he takes his hand like a karate chop, and he chops himself in the nose, you know, pantomimes it. Like, I'm going to do that to you, Rob. So they're in the middle of the match now. Now, the people don't know what's going on here. All of a sudden, you know, we're all active. And then all of a sudden, everybody stopped. There's Fuji face down in a puddle of blood. And then there's Chadi in the face down in a puddle of blood. And then there's Fuji that's going to Rob, "I'm going to chop you in the face." And Rob goes, the crowd's quieted down. They're like, "What's going on?" And Rob goes, "I didn't do it." He points to me and said, "He did it. Chop you." So you get all types of things that happen when you're young and you're just getting started. Some things are funny. I'm sure the guys watching the matches back there are probably going, "Oh, boy, look at this." So what's going to happen here? And it turned out the next week I wrestled Fuji in a single match. It was a 20-minute single match. And he was still upset. Chadi had a broken nose. I mean, his face all swelled up, and he went ahead and worked every night. But Fuji, you know, he kind of let me know, you know, early on that, "Hey, I'm unhappy about what happened last week. You know, things were stiff in that 20-minute match. I was expecting that in that 20-minute match somewhere, we're liable to have a problem." And that was one of those odd sensations when you went in the ring, not knowing what to expect. And you can't talk because he doesn't speak English. So it's just part of wrestling. It's part of learning and part of advancing and getting better. So Bockwinkel, let's go back. We'll talk Bockwinkel. Like you said, he was truly a class act. In my opinion, he could have been world champion in whatever organization, WWE or WWF back in those days, anywhere he went. And a lot of places he went, he was the champion. He got really hooked up with Gagne for a bunch of years, and I never saw him for a long time. But I did see him again in Florida a couple of years later, and I've got some great stories about Bockwinkel and Stevens working with that combination. They had another guy in there. Back in the 70s in Georgia, Paul DeMarco. Paul DeMarco was an absolute sensational worker. Just tremendous. I don't know if you're familiar with him, Brian, or not, but
sure.
He had, I called it the death walk. He had a move that just defied all sensibility of how does a guy get up from this bump. And you would knock him out or get him out on the apron, and you would hit him, and he would walk down the apron, and he would start leaning off like he's going to fall off the apron on the concrete. And at the last second, he would whip that arm out there and grab the top rope, just keep his balance. Well, you could go down there and nail him again, and he would spin around, and he would go back down that apron and take that death walk, I called it. And he would start to lean a little further this time, and he would reach out there and catch it with one finger, that rope, to save himself. And then you nail him again, and about the third or fourth time he took this little trip down the apron, he would start leaning out face first like he was going to go into the floor off the apron, and he would reach, and he wouldn't get it. And he would take a face first bump on the concrete that I never could figure out how he kept from killing himself. And the fans would just go, they would ignite the building. I mean, they were like, wow, he can't get up from that. He always got up from it. But I never saw anybody do that bump quite like he did it. And that was, to me, one of the great moves that I remember as a young guy of an old timer. Never did I get to wrestle him in single matches much because Rob and I were doing a lot of tags. But he was a phenomenal worker. He had an attitude, though. Paul DeMarco had an attitude. The boys didn't like him because he was so cocky. He called himself Mr. Confidence on interviews. Well, that was Paul DeMarco. He wasn't making an interview. He was going out there and being Paul DeMarco. He was an ass. Everybody hated him, right? Even the boys hated him. And one night, Rob and I, we were coming out of Columbus, Georgia, and he had a carload of heels with him. And they left right before we did. And we're coming back in toward Atlanta, and I see DeMarco's car's pulled over. There's a cop out there, and he's got DeMarco outside the car. And as he was going on, so the next day I asked the guys, how did that situation occur with DeMarco and the cop? And they said, well, you know how DeMarco was. He said he was speeding along there, and he said the cop pulls him over. He said the cop comes to the window. DeMarco puts the window down. He said he don't get out. He's an ass anyway. He sits and puts a window down. And the policeman says, can I see your license? And I said, what did he say? And he said, DeMarco goes, no, I don't think I really want to give you, don't you know who I am? He asked the policeman this, now the state trooper, don't you know who I am? The guys are telling me the story. And the cop says, no, he goes, I really don't know who you are, and I'd like to see your license. And he goes, don't you know that I'm Mr. Confidence Paul DeMarco? And the guys are telling me the story, and I say, what happened then? And he said, the cop just very calmly, he says, well, I'll be darned, Mr. Confidence, huh? And he says, he opened the car door, and he says, step out here, Mr. Confidence, and put your hands behind your back. And that's when we passed the car. The cop had him handcuffed with his hands behind his back. He was putting him into the cop car. And Rob was like, what the hell's going on there, right? So, Paul DeMarco, great worker, but not very well liked among the crew. The tag teams, they had Chotty and Fuji. That was their lower echelon tag team.
Well, actually, Ron, if I could jump in here real quick, because you talked about Chotty and Fuji earlier, I just want to make sure we note for the listeners who may not be aware, this is not Mr. Fuji that you guys know from the WWF. This is, his name was actually Yasu Fuji. Some of you may remember him in some of the territories as Dr. Hiro Oda. But it's not Mr. Fuji that Ron's talking about here.
That's right. And he actually, I believe, now I'm not absolutely sure about this, Brian. I always want to make sure what I'm saying is true. But I believe he goes back to Japan and he becomes a trainer for a lot of Japanese that are going to follow. And this is from the 70s on into the 80s. We train another one at Continental Wrestling that comes to us, Saito. Mr. Saito comes to us at Continental. Japan sends him to us. They say, we know you guys are doing good business, and we want this guy to learn from some of the best. So we keep Saito, Mr. Saito. This is a 19, probably 84, I'm going to guess. We keep Saito for 7 months in Continental, and he sees the likes of Arn Anderson and Ron Bass. And, we got such a phenomenal crew in there at that time. And Saito goes home to become one of the best trainers of all time. So you got this Fuji that I'm talking about that's going to go back to Japan and train Japanese wrestlers. And Saito is going to go back there, coming out of our company in 1980s, and go back to Japan and be a tremendous trainer for him for many, many years.
And on the topic of tag teams, you mentioned Shoddy and Fuji were, I don't want to say the underneath tag team, but they weren't necessarily the main event tag team at this time in 1970. But you certainly had a heck of a tag team that was.
There you go. You had, in my opinion, maybe one of the greatest tag teams of all time, the Assassins. Tom Renesto and Jody Hamilton. Gosh almighty. They were phenomenal. They were phenomenal. They were big. They looked identical. They took tremendous bumps. They led you as a heel. They called a great match. They just put you in positions to look good when they wanted you to, and to look horrible when they didn't. They were just the ideal and the epitome. Tom Renesto was the actual booker. He booked that Georgia territory. And he was the booker, and there every night he was the critical person for that company at that time. And Joe Hamilton is, I don't think anybody that knows wrestling can say enough about Jody Hamilton and what that guy could do. So now you've got Bockwinkle, and you've got DeMarco, and you've got the Assassins. You've got El Mongo, who was a big star there, with Dandy Jack Crawford. Pretty good combination right there. I mean, El Mongo had that look about him, and a great worker in the ring, could do everything in the ring. And then you've got Dandy Jack, who was a pretty big time manager, had the talk, had the gab, had the look. They had heat. This is a heel crew that had so much heat. You had Louis could certainly get it done. Had a lot of experience. He's going to become booker in Florida down the road. Knows a lot about the business. You had the Corsica Gene that we spoke about. You had a little guy called Cisco Grimaldo. Grimaldi, a little Mexican guy who was a first match guy. But that sucker could really wrestle and really do some super moves. I had great matches with him as a young guy that didn't know anything. And so if you had a heel crew like that crew, you were destined to do tremendous business. That's what it took. You had to have great heels in order to make your business fire off and to do what you wanted to get done. You have to have guys in those positions or got to be your best guys. That's odd. Most people probably don't recognize that or realize it, but it was the heels that really made things happen in wrestling.
And what a heel crew that was. I just recently mentioned to Jim Cornette on one of his shows that it's sad that El Mongol has in many ways been forgotten, but what a major star he was in Georgia for your father and Ray Gunkel. But on the topic of these heels, Ron, who had the most heat?
The Assassins probably had the most heat, obviously, in tag matches. And either way, they probably did have the most heat. Bockwinkle was in a class of his own. He had heat, but he had it in a different way. There's a lot of different types of heat. You can have heat in where they want to cut you. And I've been there. I've done that in Southeastern when I first went to Mobile. Yeah. And I've been in riots, and I've had them cut me. When you've got that kind of heat, they want to take their knives out, and they want to take a swice at you. You've got real heat, but Bockwinkle didn't have that kind of heat. Bockwinkle had a different type of heat. It was based upon him being so cool and so classy, and that people hated him and they didn't want to cut him. They wanted to see him gone. They just said, gosh, he's too good. He just needs to be out of here. Nobody can beat him. He really had that knack of getting people to just feel so inferior. He'd make them feel so inferior that they would just hate him. Like, who is this guy? He's such a jerk. He just didn't. Nick Bockwinkel really impressed me as a young wrestler. All my career, basically, Nick Bockwinkel to me was one of the key figures, maybe in the sport for many, many years. Just had tremendous talent and tremendous class. You mentioned it, and that's what I always felt about Nick. He had real class about him, and that can get heat. That can get heat with people. You can be so classy that they hate you.
On the topic of the Assassins, unfortunately, because Tom Renesto retired fairly early, I mean, not early in his career, but early in terms of video, there isn't much footage of Tom Renesto in the Assassins or in the Bolos, you know, which was another version of the same team with Jody Hamilton. So many people associate the Assassins with Jody Hamilton, him being the main interview, him being the main guy in the team. How was that different when Renesto was active? And also, for those of us who never got to see him, how was Renesto in the ring, and what kind of promo was he?
He was a super talent. He was a really super talent. You can kind of expect your booker, if you're a wrestler and you become a booker, that says, it speaks volumes for who, what capabilities you have. Because if you've got the ability to not only get it done in the ring, but to ride home at night and say, geez, this guy against that guy and this deal and that deal, whatever it may be, to figure out what's going to make things really cook. Those guys are unique and so difficult to find. You could not tell the difference between Jody Hamilton and Tom Renesto. And literally, I mean that. Obviously, they wore the same outfit, but they could switch and you wouldn't know. I mean, I've actually been in matches in which I've been there with Jody and 30 seconds, I still think I'm in there with Jody and I'm in there with Renesto. I'm like, gee, Manny, how'd they do that? You know, I mean, they were just really phenomenal team together. They had great concept of how to get heat and how to build a match. They had phenomenal matches. When they had worked with my dad and Ray Gunkel, were some of the greatest matches, tag matches I ever saw, because you had all this talent and all this experience, and you've got those guys calling that match over there, and they're both brilliant guys. It's easy. It's easy to go out there and have a great match with them. Rob and I were able to do it in that first 3 months. We knew nothing at all, and they liked us enough that we had a long program with them, probably a 2-month program in which we wrestled the Assassins darn near every night. And that's what helps you become a better wrestler. When you go in there, you can only be as good as the man you're in the ring with. And especially when you're a babyface and you're young, you need that great heel that can lead you and make you look great. And they made me and Rob look great. I mean, fabulous in our early days there in Georgia. And that couldn't have done it with another. Chadi and Fuji could not do it with us. We could have never become any type of stars. And we started within 2 or 3 months becoming stars. We basically got shots at the tag team champions and darn near won them on a couple occasions.
For every great heel, you need a great babyface. And what an interesting crew you have here, because you have a lot of young wrestlers, like we said earlier. You have some experienced veterans, and you also have guys who are, at this point in time already, legends in Georgia, like your father and Ray Gunkel. So let's talk a little bit about this babyface crew, who the heels are going to be going against in the ring every night.
Yes, and the babyface crew is as good as the heel crew. And I mean, when you do this, what you have is I remember, I'll never forget that 1970 crew when I started in Georgia as being one of the best crews I ever worked with anywhere in the world. They were really, really good. You had, besides Dad and Ray Gunkel, you had Doug Gilbert, the wrestling pro, who had a great run in Georgia, became a huge star there. He wore a mask. He's kind of the predecessor to Wrestling 2. I mean, he sets the stage as a masked wrestling babyface. He was really, really good. You had Dick Steinborn. Gosh almighty, what a phenomenal talent. He's going to work for me in Southeastern in the 70s. He's just one of the great workers of all time and could get it done wrestling heel or babyface. It didn't make any difference. In fact, I remember that Doug Gilbert got hurt and Steinborn wrestled for 3 weeks as the wrestling pro. And I don't know that the fans knew it wasn't the wrestling pro. It was like amazing. I watched the match and said, geez, he is the wrestling pro. How does he do that? He just picked up his mannerisms. He duplicated the guy in the ring. I don't know that people even knew the wrestling pro was hurt for 3 weeks because Steinborn would work twice in the same night. He would go out there and do his match and he'd dress up and go back and do the wrestling pro and they didn't know it was him. That's how much talent he had.
And quite a character as well.
Oh, gosh, an amazing guy, a fun guy, a brilliant guy. I knew his dad very well, Milo. Milo was one of the strongest men in the history of wrestling or any other sport. Milo was just a monstrously strong son of a gun who owned Orlando. And every time you went and worked on Monday nights in Florida, you worked for Milo in Orlando. And Dickie, his son, was just a brilliant son of a gun, very good at everything, knowledgeable, a really great guy. Just really loved being around Dick Steinborn. We had Bill Dromo. There's another experienced guy that's in there with these experienced heels, and he's going to give you a great match every night. We already mentioned Bob Armstrong, great talent there. He's going to be a Hall of Famer. And he had all these heels. It didn't make any difference who you put him in the ring with. He's going to have a great match because they're going to lead him. They're going to make that match unbelievable. He's going to add that fire that Bob was always famous for. And you put that combination together, you can't have anything but a phenomenal match that fans are going to go home talking about. You had Rob and I, young guys. Dad's background, we worked a lot of six-man tags early on in that first 3 months in the business, and the three of us, Dad, Rob, and I, we had some great, phenomenal matches with, didn't make any difference who we were in there with, because Dad was kind of leading he was kind of putting us where we needed to be and making it easy for us. And there was another guy there named Solento Rodriguez. Are you familiar with him, Brian?
I am. He was a deaf wrestler.
That's absolutely right. Deaf wrestler, tremendous talent, great wrestler. I don't know how he did it. I could never figure out without ears and without being able to talk and without being able to hear, not just the guy that's leading you, but the crowd. You know, I mean, it was like, and he never failed to have a great match. I was lucky enough to wrestle with him in the babyface match. And it was an experience for me. It was like, I was concerned when I saw it on the card. How am I going to have a match with a guy that can't hear? And he made it so easy. So this type of crew, when you've got that much talent, you can't help but have a great night for fans every single night. It doesn't make any difference how you mix them up. You could take those names and pull them out of a hat and have babyface matches or heels against heels. It doesn't make any difference because the talent is so significant there that you can't book anything bad. You got to look like a brilliant booker when you've got a crew like that because they can certainly get it done for you.
So many people helped you and Rob. So many people hated Paul DeMarco. But in general, how was this crew? Was it a close crew? Did everyone get along?
Except for DeMarco. You know, everybody, you know, they had all had the same feeling about DeMarco. And that didn't just happen with Paul in that territory. Later on, he goes to Mid-Atlantic and he goes to work for Crockett. And Les Thatcher's a friend of mine. Les Thatcher tells me a story about DeMarco that's kind of like my story about him getting arrested. He says that him and Paul Jones and a couple of other guys, they're having a Sunday picnic party type of deal. And DeMarco shows up there, and there's a few girls around. So DeMarco's trying to be the star, and he wants to take over the afternoon. He's not invited, and he just shows up. And they've got a trampoline in the backyard. So Thatcher says that Paul gets up on the trampoline, and he starts just going as high as he can go. And he says every time he goes, now he's up, he says he may be going 30 feet high. He says, I've never seen anybody jump that high on a trampoline. And he goes, but we're watching him, and every time he comes down, he's about 6 inches further back than where he left the time before. And he says, we're all pissed at him as usual. He goes, you know, we're wanting to see him hurt himself or whatever. He says he jumps maybe 15 times. Now he's up there at 30 feet or whatever. And he says he's slowly moving back. He says he misses the platform, and he goes down. One of his legs goes down between the springs that make the trampoline work. And he hangs himself upside down and breaks his leg. So he says, we're all disincented. And he says, and nobody wanted to help him get off the trampoline. He's got his leg hooked in there, and he's got a broken leg, and he's screaming. And he says, we're all laughing so hard that we can't help him to get out of the trampoline. So you've got, other than that, it was a great crew. You had, and that's so important too, Brian, in running a territory and having a territory that does great business is you want that dressing room to be vibrant. You want it to be a happy place. You want to have everybody involved and everybody having a good time. There were always certain guys in crews that I really liked. I would use them simply because of their ability to get everybody in the right frame of mind. Don Carson was one. Don Carson was he's a motivator in the dressing room. He came in there smiling and laughing, and he had everybody in that dressing room going, wow, this is great. I love this territory. And that's what you wanted to have. If you could have a territory in which you had that atmosphere, you had talent like this group right here we're talking about, there's no way you're not going to sell out every town you go to. And that's basically what happened there in the 3 or 4 months I started in early Georgia.
And we're going to talk more about this crew and your early experiences next week on the show. We're going to talk about you learning what works and what doesn't work. And of course, you and Rob getting your very first, not your last, but your very first tag team title shot. A big show next week. But now, before we wrap things up, a few notes. We want to remind everyone the 2-hour Ron Wright Super Studcast is off to a great start, and the 1-hour question and answer rest of the Ron Wright story will be available on Sunday, February 25th. The Andre the Giant Super Studcast is still growing in popularity. You can get both now at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. Thank you. Sincerely, thank you to all the patrons for supporting the stud, especially the one, and we're going to let him remain anonymous, who donated $250 to the program. Thank you so much. If you like what we do, you are welcome to leave a donation at any time to help ensure the continuation of all 7 hours of Studcast each month, and of course get access to the Super Studcast. Once again, tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. You can follow the Tennessee Stud on Twitter and Instagram at Ron Fuller Welch. You can follow me on Twitter at Great Brian Last, and you can follow the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network on Twitter at Super Podcast. You can also follow the Tennessee Stud on Facebook at Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. The Studcast is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. For the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller, I'm the Great Brian Last. The story continues next week.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
1, 2, 3.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.